From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Strange Encounters with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. At the end of the program tonight, because St. Paddy's Day is Saturday, Christian Wilde will sing his rendition of "O Danny Boy," and you don't want to miss it. As a matter of fact, tape it. Play it back whenever you want. Well, last night in our program with Dr. John Curtis and Howard Bloom, two go in, one comes out, the great debate. Final results are in. You voted. Dr. John Curtis had 77% saying he won the thing, 20% for Howard Bloom, and the other 3% said it was a draw. Here's what's happening. Four people at least confirmed dead after a newly installed pedestrian bridge at Florida's International University collapsed today, leaving eight vehicles trapped under the sprawling wreckage. Miami-Dade Fire Chief Dave Downey told reporters at a news conference that four people were killed after the structure, touted as an instant bridge, collapsed about 1:30 p.m. at the Miami Area University. It was a very sad story. A number of other people taken to the hospital, some of them in critical condition. Tests on major brands of bottled water have found that nearly all of them contain tiny particles of plastic. In the largest investigation of its kind, 250 bottles bought in nine different countries were examined. The research led by a journalism organization called Orb Media discovered an average of 10 plastic particles per liter, each larger than the width of a human hair. Companies whose brands were tested told the BBC that their bottling plants were operating at the highest standards, but obviously not. The Trump administration has blamed the Russian government for a campaign of cyber attacks stretching back at least 2 years that targeted the U.S. power grid, marking the first time the United States has publicly accused Moscow of hacking into American energy infrastructure. And also because of so-called meddling, the Trump administration has tossed new sanctions on Russia. The next leader of Saudi Arabia says his country would quickly obtain a nuclear bomb if arch-rival Iran successfully develops its own nuclear weapon. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman made the statement about a possible nuclear arms race in the Middle East. He said that on CBS Morning News. Dr. Jerome Corsi with us here. Jerry, what do you think about this tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
It seems to be growing, and it concerns me that Saudi Arabia might develop a nuclear weapon. This has been one of the great concerns over Iran, and that is it could lead to nuclear proliferation in the region, which would be extremely dangerous.
Sure would. Jerry wrote a book, of course, called Atomic Iran, as he watched this whole thing unfold. That could be dangerous in the area. And what about the latest with Russia apparently doing cyber attacks on us?
It seems that Russia's stepping up its aggressive nature across the globe. And if this is a new move for Russia to kind of destabilize U.S. power and assert its own power, it could lead to a confrontational situation. I mean, it worries me that we've had so much Russia baiting over the last couple of years. I'd like to think that we could come to some accommodation with Russia's two superpowers working together. But at the moment, the relationship seems to be deteriorating between us and Russia.
And some are saying, Jerry, that this is worse now than the Cold War of the 60s.
I've seen that, George, and it troubles me. I again, remember when John Kennedy, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, reached out to Nikita Khrushchev and bypassed all the military and intelligence agencies to come to a direct accord. And I'd like to think that kind of direct negotiation and seeing eye to eye could happen again.
And Jerry, with the situation between the United States and Russia, Putin coming up for re-election, lots of things are going on. You're going to be on our program soon as you talk about your new book, Killing the Deep State. This is one of the most tense times I've felt in a long time. How about you?
I completely agree, George. Everywhere you look, I mean, I'm very hopeful North Korea will resolve without a war. But then we have Iran right on top of it developing nuclear weapons, and that's going to be a tension. And then just the increasing tensions between the United States and Russia, which could lead to a new kind of missile escalation, nuclear weapon proliferation, which is being discussed. These are very frightening times, and I'd like to think that the governments of the world could come to some accord where we get beyond this constant belligerence.
I agree. Jerry, thank you so much. And Jerry also works with InfoWars.com. Russia says they will launch a mission to Mars as early as next year, according to Vladimir Putin. The ambitious unmanned craft will be just the first, and other manned missions to follow soon after a bid to colonize the Red Planet. How about that? What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you have for us this week?
Well, good evening, George. I'd like to make a slight departure tonight from what's become my normal UFO update format, and I'd like to begin with a couple of comments about Stephen Hawking's passing, which you first reported on, I believe, two nights ago.
Absolutely. And just, by the way, in a moment, Leonard Mlodinow will be with us to talk about Mr. Hawking's life. But go ahead, Peter.
I'll be tuned in to listen to that. That sounds very interesting. Well, given that Hawking warned us about what we might expect when an overt encounter first takes place between mankind and sentient beings from another part of our universe, it's ironic, I feel, that he should have died on the 21st anniversary of the Great Phoenix Lights event, which occurred on a Thursday night, March 13, 1997, of course. In fact, I calculate that the hour of Hawking's death early on Wednesday morning, local time in the UK, occurred at about the same time that the Phoenix Lights event had begun in Arizona 21 years earlier. I'm not one who necessarily subscribes to astrology or numerology or related subjects, a fact for which I pray the Coast listeners and guests will forgive me, but the timing of Hawking's death does seem to be a noteworthy coincidence worth mentioning. And while on the subject of the Phoenix Lights, George, and since tonight is the anniversary of that dramatic event, I'd like to add a couple of items here.
Sure.
Whereas most people, and in particular Coast listeners, I feel, are familiar with the case, I observe that many people still are unaware of how shockingly dramatic that event really was. First, it lasted for approximately 2 hours, a very long time for a UFO sighting, and it involved five or possibly even six objects that were unimaginably large by terrestrial standards. For example, the triangular or chevron-shaped craft that hovered over Camelback Mountain for an estimated 5 minutes at approximately 8:35 p.m. that night was an estimated 8 terrestrial statute miles in width from wingtip to wingtip. It was the size of a medium-sized city on the planet Earth. And the reason we know this is because the pilot who reportedly had intercepted that object in a U.S. Air Force F-15 fighter upon returning to Luke Air Force Base reported to members of his ground crew that the object had been at 9,000 feet above ground level at the time of the intercept. Combine that fact with the fact that witnesses on the ground reported that the object, when viewed from their vantage point near the base of Camelback Mountain, subtended an arc of approximately 135 degrees above them in the night sky. Those two bits of information are sufficient to allow calculation of the object's width, which translates to 8.23 terrestrial statute miles. Any high school student who has taken trigonometry should be able to do that and make the same calculation. In closing, George, I'll be posting recent sighting reports over the upcoming weekend once our webmaster returns from his current travels. And in the meantime, I hope you and all the Coast listeners have an enjoyable weekend.
Thank you, Peter. Peter's website, UFOCenter.com. A Texas state representative came under fire on social media over a tweet about famed British physicist Stephen Hawking that some found insensitive. Just hours after Hawking died, Representative Briscoe Kane tweeted, "Stephen Hawking now knows the truth about how the universe was actually made. My condolences to his family." I don't think that the state representative was trying to be insensitive at all. I think he was trying to say that Stephen Hawking, of course, now is up there with God and now gets it. So that's my take on that. In a moment, we're going to continue talking about the life of physicist Stephen Hawking with a friend of his and the Coast to Coast guest, Leonard Mlodinow. And later on in the program tonight, we'll talk about Leonard's new book, Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. You're not going to get any sleep tonight because the program that executive producer Lisa Lyon and producer Tom Danheiser put together will keep you riveted and up all night. Later on in the program, we're going to end the show with Christian Wilde's version of Oh Danny Boy. You don't want to miss that. Rosemary Ellen Guiley will join us about her new work. It's called The Road to Strange. That'll keep you up. And for the next couple hours, we're going to be talking about Stephen Hawking and, of course, the latest book called Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change by Leonard Mlodinow. Dr. Mlodinow is a theoretical physicist, and he's an author, was on the faculty of the California Institute of Technology. He's also got other books out there, including The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos, and a dear friend of Stephen Hawking. As a matter of fact, he has co-authored books with Stephen Hawking, A Brief History of Time, of course. Leonard, welcome to the program, and our condolences to the loss of your friend.
Thank you, George.
He was just one of a kind. I wanted to get your take, by the way, on this Texas representative. He's being attacked from all fronts about his tweet. I don't think he was trying to be insensitive. I think he was just trying to say that Stephen has passed on, he's up there with God, and now he knows the truth. Hey, what do you think?
I'm with you. I heard what you said when you read that, and it sounded innocuous to me. People are just looking for fights these days, I guess. I don't know if there's anything more to what he said, but from the tweet that you read, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you back, and we'll talk about some of your latest works in just a moment. But give me your thoughts on Stephen. I mean, what a guy to, first of all, to fight the ALS disease that he fought for so many years and to continue to be the kind of person he was, both personally and it was with his thought process. Absolutely incredible, huh?
Yeah, he does seem superhuman in that sense, both that, you know, he was given 2 or 3 years to live when I think he was 21, and he had already been symptomatic for a little bit before that, and then he went for 55 years after that, you know, and you combine that with the fact that maybe, let me tell you, as a physicist, here's something that boggles my mind. You know, we all, if you ever watched a physicist work, which you may not have, You work on a pad of paper scrawling equations or on a blackboard. You've seen in movies blackboards covered with equations, and we do that because your mind can't track everything. And, of course, he couldn't do that, and he did it all in his head. And he obviously accomplished tremendous breakthroughs in science and with you know, all picturing it all in his head. That's another, to me, that's equally miraculous as the living the 55 years. It's not something I can imagine anyone doing, and it just shows you that he was built, you know, physically and mentally built differently, and unfortunately, I don't know what causes that disease, but, you know, he that was tragic, but he was the guy who could withstand it.
Absolutely. How did you get to know him? How did that start for you?
Well, I first met him briefly at a talk that he gave at Princeton that I was just attending in the audience and on his work. And then some years later, I got a call from him from his assistant asking if I wanted to work with him. He had read my first book, and he liked it, and he was looking for someone to work with, to write books with. And he asked me. I didn't have to think very long before accepting that one.
Well, I'm glad that he and you got together because you put out some riveting information. And I remember a couple of years ago, Leonard, when you were on with me, we talked about Stephen Hawking's belief of God. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were saying he's a believer.
Well, you know, he didn't believe in God, the kind of God that is in our religions. But any physicist believes in a certain order in the world,
yeah,
and that the world follows certain rules, and that is a kind of some people would call it pantheism, or it's a version of that which has a long history. But you know, he didn't believe in the Christian or Muslim, Jewish, or any of the kinds of gods that we believe in, but very strong, had a very strong belief that the universe follows rules, and they, you know, they are never disobeyed. There are no, so as opposed to ordinary religion, which talks about miracles in the past, at least, he believed very strongly that there are no miracles. This order governs everything in the universe, and it all runs according to the plan. That was the grand design that we spoke about. So it was a different kind of a grand design, but it was a grand design.
No question about it. One could say it was a different kind of God, you know, different from what the religious folks believe, but some higher power nonetheless, whatever it might be.
Some power of mathematics and physics.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you sit back and think about the complexity of the universe, but as you mentioned, everything seems to have order to it. I mean, that by itself is remarkable. I'm really beginning to think maybe we do live in a digital world and somebody or something just created us on some computer. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's amusing, and it's a nice science fiction idea. And, it could be true. It's one of those ideas that you can't disprove. If we are all beings in a big computer that was designed to make the world run this way, there's no way of distinguishing between that and it not being that way. So as a scientist, I don't think too much about those philosophical questions. It's kind of like Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, once said, how do I know there aren't teacups orbiting Jupiter? Maybe it was Saturn, I don't remember. And he said, well, I can't tell. Of course, now we could. But back then he said, I can't tell, so I don't worry about such things. And so it's really one of those questions. Someone could say that there are teacups orbiting Jupiter, and I couldn't disprove it. And so I can't say that the person is wrong. But as a scientist, I like to focus my beliefs on what there's evidence in favor of, not what there's no evidence against.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think sometimes, what if we're just this grand scheme of artificial intelligence at some high level that has this ability now to reason, think, and everything else? And it's kind of weird to think about that. But then I get right back to there's more to this. This is physical. It's here. I don't understand it. I still don't get the Big Bang, Leonard, at all. Maybe you could help me with that. I don't get how something could start from nothing. I just don't understand it.
Well, that is hard to grasp. A lot of ideas in modern physics are hard to grasp when you first bump into them if you're not used to thinking about them. And it's the kind of thing when you're a physicist and you become a student, you start solving, you learn the equations, you start solving the problems and doing the math, and you start seeing a different world. You have no experience with atoms, for instance, right?
Right.
So atoms, I have no concrete experience, but I solved dozens or hundreds of physics problems that have to do with atoms using the equations that we learn. And through each of those problems, you form a picture in your head of the atom and how they behave. And now I have this intuition about how atoms behave that has nothing to do with me seeing them. It has to do with me knowing the theories. And it's the same thing with the Big Bang and the universe from nothing. And that's based on, so the Einstein's theory of the Big Bang didn't have a universe coming from nothing. But when you add quantum theory to it, you know, you've heard of the famous quantum fluctuations where things come and they go, and do they exist or not? There's an uncertainty, and you can't define everything exactly. And it's those ideas that allow the universe to come from nothing. And you have to really get familiar with those ideas before it starts to make sense to you.
It is really mind-boggling, though, isn't it?
But let me boggle your mind, love. Okay, before we boggle our mind quite there, let's just boggle our mind with something even in a way more fundamental.
Sure. Which
is that matter warps space and time. That's something that everyone's heard.
Yeah.
And as the universe, we go back in time, and this is one of the things that Stephen studied. As we go back in time, the universe was smaller and smaller and smaller as it goes back toward the Big Bang. And as it gets smaller and smaller, all the stuff that's here now is packed into a smaller and smaller volume. If you go back far enough, it would be packed into a volume of the size of a volleyball or a grapefruit or a lemon or a marble.
Amazing.
Or a pinhead. And at some point, when it gets, when all this amazing, you know, tremendous amount of matter and energy gets squashed down that tightly, the warpage of space and time is so great that you may as well forget about space and time as we know it.
Hold on, Leonard. Let's come right back to that and then talk about your work, Elastic, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, everybody in the greater Scottsdale, Phoenix area, April 21st, come on out to our next live stage show. It's going to be a dandy. Travis Walton will be there, by the way. Remember him? A great story, Fire in the Sky. But that's going to be, again, April 21st. I'll tell you how you can get your tickets. We call it the Scottsdale Invasion, and tickets are selling briskly there, but definitely come on out there. And then also in Las Vegas on June 9th, we've got another great live event there. Full information is at coasttocoastam.com under the events. Now, with Scottsdale, pick your tickets and have some fun. In Las Vegas, all the VIP tickets have been bought already. They're all sold out, but there's still plenty of great seats left. So simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. At the top, you'll see events. Click that. The pages will open up, or also in our carousel, those revolving pictures right on the homepage, the second to the last button right around there, just click that and it'll open up for you there too. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Leonard Mlodinow with us, his latest work, Elastic. We'll get into that in just a second. So, Leonard, you were talking about this incredible compression of matter into the size of a volleyball, maybe even smaller, I guess, right?
Right. The further back in time you go, the smaller it is. And so the really bizarre thing that happens is because of the warpage of space-time, when the density of matter and energy gets so high that they really become unrecognizable. If you imagine, sometimes people imagine space as a sheet, two-dimensional sheet, and when you press on it, that's warping it. Well, now imagine you took that and you scrunched it up into like some kind of a piece of paper that you scrunch up in your hand before you throw it away. It gets that bent up that doesn't even make sense at that point to talk about space and time as being different, or to talk about what came first. It all gets somewhat meaningless. And so if you go to the question of how did something come from nothing, or what happened at the beginning, it becomes a meaningless question, because actually space and time don't have the meaning that we intuitively feel that they have if you go back far enough. That's what physics tells us.
Let's talk a little bit about elastic, flexible thinking at a time of change. What is elastic thinking?
Well, elastic thinking is what brings us all the great things in the world, all the inventions, the new ideas, the creativity. I define two kinds of thinking that the human brain engages in. One is very familiar to us. It's rational, logical thought. It's what computers can very easily execute. You just put one foot in front of the other. You just follow the rules. You do your math according to the way the equations work. You just follow logical steps one to another. And that's fine too. Once everything is set for you and the framework of your thinking is all set up, people have come up with the theory or the ideas, you can carry out, find out all the conclusions using that kind of thinking. But the other thinking is where the ideas come from. It's the imagination. It's the integrating different areas of life. It's making odd associations that people wouldn't think of. Elastic thinking allows you to build a car that drives itself. But, I mean, rational thinking allows a computer to drive a car. You just put in the rules and it drives the car. But elastic thinking is what allows a human to invent the car. A computer is never going to invent the car, at least not until it has a brain like a human, because we can have these, we have a kind of brain that can create something from nothing, to bring in the physics again. We can come up with new ideas and see things in a different way and challenge our assumptions. We don't have to follow the rules. We can break the rules. We can invent or discover the new rules. That's elastic thinking.
Is it difficult to think that way?
Well, different people have different capacities for both analytical and elastic thinking, but all humans have elastic thinking built into the brain, and this is because about 130,000 years ago, there was a great climatic disaster, and humans became almost extinct. There were just a few dozen humans left, and the ones that survived were the ones that were more exploratory, that loved that are more attracted to change. Psychologists call it neophilia, love of change, love of something new. And those humans who are more exploratory and bolder manage to survive. And then after the climate settled down, suddenly, because the humans now had this neophilic character, they started to spread around the world, as we obviously eventually did. Before that happened, they were pretty much concentrated in certain parts of Africa. So this kind of genetic determination has gotten put into our heads, and so we all have that capacity, and we use it to explore, we use it to invent, we use it to innovate, and we can all develop it in ourselves. It's there, and everyone has it in a different capacity, but there are certain exercises and things you can do to nurture your own elastic thinking.
How would you have categorized Stephen Hawking and the way he was thinking?
Well, see, that's a good question. So he's a great example of an elastic thinker, because what did he do? He didn't carry forth theories of physics to the next degree. He threw out the old theories and invented the new ones. Even when he started his work as a PhD student, he was totally bored with physics. And he got interested in these things called black holes. People said black holes is a dead-end field. People were not interested in black holes or Einstein's relativity very much back then. Black hole, they thought, well, hey, black hole is something we're never going to see. It's not relevant for the we're never going to be able to experiment on it. And so why think about it? And he was one of the few people who was working on that field and showed how important it was and made tremendous breakthroughs and discovered new things about it. And throughout his life, he was always a revolutionary, just as he was a revolutionary in living, even when they said you have 2 years to live.
That's right.
And so that, and in his, if you look at his life, I mean, he was so, talk about the gene for exploration and novelty. He went on that vomit comet. Do you know what that is, George? The
Oh, yeah.
They call it a vomit comet for a reason.
It's an obvious reason.
Yeah. It goes 747. It flies up and down and up and down. And
like you're in space,
like
right?
Following a parabola so that when you're in that thing and it's in free fall, you experience
weightlessness.
Seconds of weightless, right? Yeah. Weightless. So that's how you can, without going into space, you can experience weightlessness. And a lot of people, they vomit from it, you know. And Stephen, of course, with all his disability and his fragility, his physical fragility, people were saying, his doctor said, don't do this, don't do this. He said, I'm doing it. And he went and he did it. And he was floating, as tremendous pictures of him floating there. And he felt like he was liberated, because he's liberated from his body, because gravity is keeping him down and he has no muscle to move. And now suddenly he's floating and he loved it. And he did. And he was, one time I was, when I was working with him, one of his caregivers said, let's go punting down the Cam, which is a thing you kind of float down the Cambridge River on a flat boat, and someone stands with a big pole and pushes you along. It's a little dicey to me because the thing can turn over or you can fall off.
Oh, my God, yeah.
The person who's pushing it can fall, I mean, if you're not careful. And guess what? He wanted to come along. We had to carry him down maybe 40 concrete steps of his wheelchair. This is not a disability.
He drowns if that thing flips over.
Exactly. He would totally drown. In fact, when you carry him, you have to hold his head in a certain way because he didn't have the muscles to hold his head up. Can you imagine? I was like scared when we were doing that because I'm thinking, what if, I step on the wrong thing and the boat tips over? And,
yeah.
It was amazing, and he did it, and he loved new experiences and being adventurous. So so he was elastic in all aspects, personal, professional. It was amazing.
Was Einstein elastic as well?
Oh yeah. See, that's the thing, that if you look at some of the great thinkers in physics, elastic thinkers are the ones who change the paradigm. They don't follow the
outside of the box, as we say.
Exactly. Huge section of the book where I talk about outside the box, and I have a exercise to see if you can do that and how you do that, and talk about what structures in your brain allow you. Your brain has certain filters that inhibit you from doing stuff like that, because they want to keep you from being crazy. Your brain, unless you're a schizophrenic, for instance, your brain keeps you certain conventional and in touch with reality. And these same filters that do that, they also keep out new ideas. And so that's why people like Einstein that are famous icons who were a little bit weird with the crazy hair and didn't wear socks. I mean, back before it became fashionable not to he would pick up, he wasn't allowed to smoke, so he'd pick up cigarette butts off the street and smoke those.
He would smoke them? Jeez.
Yeah. So you know, he was a little bit odd, but he had those thoughts. So he revolutionized physics, just like Hawking did. And so a lot of the people who think a little bit differently also behave differently.
And you don't have to be a scientist to be an elastic thinker, do you?
No, of course it's important in art and music and writing. It's important in your everyday life, because if you're not an elastic thinker, you get stuck in a rut. You don't question where your life is going. You might not be very happy, but you don't think about it. You don't question it, and you just keep moving forward in whatever field or relationship or whatever structure you have to your life. But if you're an elastic thinker, you'll question that, and you'll find something better if need be.
It's amazing how that can be. I mean, you've looked at Mary Shelley, the originator of Frankenstein, as an elastic thinker. Miles Davis, the great jazz player.
That's right. A lot of the famous people in the arts were very good at elastic thinking, and they behaved a little bit strangely, but they had great ideas. And with Mary Shelley, the point I was making there was one point when that important point or way to nurture elastic thinking is to make your mind blank. When you're really focused on something and you're using your reason and your logic, you're going to push forward until you get to something, but you might hit a barrier that you can't get through because the rules don't take you through that barrier, and you have to jump over it. And the way to do that is to stop pushing yourself and just relax, take a shower, jog. In her case, she was just laying in bed trying to chill, trying to sleep late at night. She said, I gave up with coming up with this story. It's not going to work. And she just sat there, relaxed, and bam, it popped into her head. So,
if you're not an elastic thinker, what are you?
Well, then you are, if you're totally not an elastic thinker, you could be the stereotype of an engineer or an accountant. I'm not saying that those people aren't, but the stereotype or the stereotype of scientists sometimes who have the thick glasses and just hunch over, very super literal.
Very deliberate in what they do.
They follow all the rules. They never want to break a rule. They take, if something doesn't care if it doesn't make sense, if it's written that way, they're going to follow it.
They're methodical.
Yeah, well, super methodical. Right, exactly.
I'm getting a picture right now on some people I know who are elastic and some people who are not. I would say that most really successful people are more elastic than those that are great people, but they seem to be rigid in some specialized field. For example, like you said, accounting, they don't go beyond that.
Right, I agree. The most successful people are innovators, leaders, people with new ideas, and they're elastic thinkers. They have to hire people to execute perhaps some of the plans that they have, but they're the ones who come up with the plans.
And Leonard, I would say, you might think I'm nuts here, but I would say that some homeless people are elastic thinkers.
Oh, yeah.
Because, they, if you've ever, I see a lot of them in Denver and Los Angeles, if you ever drive past where they are, they're living in these modified cardboard boxes. They've got all these things. They've got a cart full of stuff, a shopping cart full of stuff that they and they just seem to know what they're doing. That's pretty elastic to me.
That's right. I mean, never would have thought of that, but absolutely, they have a lifestyle that people haven't defined for them. They have to make up their own, and they have to make do with whatever they can get.
Yeah, I couldn't live in a cardboard box, but they've got it. They put doors and windows in it. I mean,
they have to find ways to keep warm. They can't just go out and buy a thicker coat.
That's
or
right.
If they want to brush their teeth, they might not have the toothbrush. They have to improvise.
It's amazing. What about little kids? Are they elastic?
Little kids, I talk about that in the book. Yes, they are, and that's because those filters I was talking about earlier, they don't mature, and they're the last part of your brain to mature, and doesn't happen until you're about 25. So that's why little kids will say the craziest things. They don't have that filter, right?
That's right.
Or they'll do the craziest things. Like when I was a kid, I jumped off the roof of my school just for fun. I'm old enough now to know better. But
Did you break your legs?
I screwed up my ankle. Yeah.
Oh my God! How high was the jump?
It was like 12 feet or something.
That's still a lot of pressure on your ankles when you hit the ground.
Yeah, it was. I think I was a month before I could walk again or something. It was.
Did you learn your lesson? Or did you try to do it again next time?
That's the thing. You don't learn the lesson when you're that age because to learn the lesson, your brain, first your brain has to develop the filters, and it's part of your prefrontal cortex, and then, of course, you have to program it with such experiences. But if the filters aren't even there, there's nothing to program, and so you just keep doing stuff like that. And I made explosives as a kid. I blew up, burned my arms up to my shoulder, horrible pain.
Jeez.
I mean, I had a lot of...
You were elastic.
I was elastic, yeah. But I, you know, thank God I don't...
Well, you were dangerous elastic.
To myself, yeah.
Yeah.
I was.
We're finding out things about you, Leonard, we never knew before.
So you know, when you get older and you get certain kinds of dementia, you can get frontal lobe dementia.
You can do that.
And that can affect your filters. So my dad, he had a stroke, and I talk about this in the book. He had a stroke in where his filters are in his brain. And like I was walking to a table in a restaurant once, and he was hungry, and he walked by someone's table. They had French fries on the table. He grabbed a few. I mean, we might all think that, but we won't. The thought will probably not even come to our consciousness. But if it does, we won't behave according to it. But when those filters are gone, you'll do those things.
I love studying books on the brain like yours, Elastic, and I have found out that people who suffer lots of bouts of déjà vu. Might have temporal lobe epilepsy, and it's a little quirk in the brain caused by something, but they get these incredible feelings of deja vu, and I guess it's pretty common.
Yeah, that actually makes sense. Yeah, so I mean, it doesn't just affect your motor system, but it affects your thinking as well. It really does.
Where do you get this book, Elastic? What are you picking up? Amazon?
You can order it online now, pre-order. It's out on Tuesday officially. It'll be
we're ahead of the game here.
Yes, we are. It's on Amazon.com. You can order it, Barnes & Noble, or your local indie books, your local independent bookstores or chain bookstores. Thankfully, my books end up being everywhere, so you won't have trouble finding it, so please buy it.
Did you ever think you'd become a physicist when you were younger?
I was always really interested in chemistry. I thought I was going to be a chemist.
I had a chemistry set. I used to dabble in the basement of my folks' house, house. I would mix and match and do all kinds of things. I loved it.
Seen the days before computer games. We had to find something to entertain us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Leonard, we're going to come back, final hour to go with you. We're going to take phone calls as we talk about the life of Stephen Hawking, space, you name it, we've got it, with the physicist Dr. Leonard Mlodinow right here on Coast to Coast AM. And make the call. You'll love it.